Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jason Eakin.
And I'm BJ Gailey. And this is Experts and Intermediates.
It sure is.
Okay, so what is this? Experts and Intermediates. To make a long story short, we want to do this podcast because we thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk about all different kinds of art and entertainment.
Right. Or at least a couple different kinds.
At least a couple different kinds each time, two or three. Movies, music, books. Television, comic books.
Possibly comic books.
Sure. Video games. Flat art, as I call it. painting. Sculpture. Each week, Jason and I are going to give each other assignments. Maybe a film I've not yet been introduced to, since Jason certainly has a wider experience there. And maybe...
Or one of about 15,000 CDs that BJ owns that I've never heard of.
Right.
So that's basically going to be what it is, yeah. Is each week we'll give each other an assignment, and the next week we'll come back, and we may stagger the assignments, especially with the literature, because we're both about the same in literature.
Yes, I think so.
And we've read different things, so it's exciting.
Yeah, and we may occasionally revisit something that we've both experienced, but it's been a while.
Right.
Or we feel like relates to something we just talked about.
Yeah.
You know, just try and spot those connections as popular.
Exactly. Also, if we get big enough, I think a good idea is... that listeners can write in their recommendations for us, because they'll probably get to sense what we like and what we don't like, or things that, you know, they've experienced that we haven't, and maybe we can both watch a certain movie or read a book or listen to some great new music.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to especially one segment that I think we're pretty excited about.
Oh dear God!
The possibly titled "Will We Be Corrupted?" segment.
Or will we be infected?
Will we be infected? Oh, that's I like that.
And here's what this is. Because there's so many things out there. To give a brief example, Dreamgirls, which I hate. I hate with a fiery passion. But if I hadn't seen it, I'd still know that I was probably going to hate it.
Right.
But I couldn't be sure. There may be a little doubt there, or maybe no doubt at all. I'm not sure. Because I knew I was going to hate that.
I was going to say, knowing you in that movie,
hate that movie,
there was no doubt.
But I saw it in theaters, and I was right, as I always am. So we're going to do a segment where we take maybe a book or a movie that we haven't seen, or that we have seen but haven't seen for a little while, that most people, critically at least, do not like.
Yeah, and maybe it has huge popular appeal.
Massive popular appeal. That's
Sex and the City is jumping out.
A Sex and the City marathon in which we watch we'll poll women and see which season they say is the absolute best.
Yes.
And then we will watch that entire season within the course of like 2 days.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
2 days for all the episodes. Or... I think Left Behind books.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to check those out.
We were going to jump in. For some reason, book 8 just seems right. It just seems right.
That's the thing. If we're not going to enjoy it, we might as well confuse the hell out of ourselves.
Exactly. An entire Beyonce album.
Mm-hmm. I actually own that.
You're kidding.
No, I am kidding.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. I was about to throw out your expert status.
I've already been infected. But you get the idea. We're basically going to sit through these excruciating, quote-unquote, artistic experiences.
That's right.
To see what effect they have on what we feel is a normal human's taste. Although, evidently, we're kind of in left field, given the popular acclaim of Dreamgirls and Sex and
exactly.
the City. And Left Behind.
It's true. It's true. We are going to get started. We're going to take a... we're not going to take a break. Screw breaks.
Yeah, let's keep going.
We are going to get started with section one, or segment one, which is The Killers. We're doing music.
Yes.
Recently, BJ and I got the chance to go to a Killers concert.
Yeah. City Market. What, last Friday?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It was City Market, downtown Kansas City. Mm-hmm. So we went. I think opening for them was Hot, Hot Heat.
And mystery band number one from New York.
Mystery band from New York. It was
Romance?
Like
Red Romance?
Red Romance Explosion.
Romance Explosion.
Romance Explosion from New York.
We'll call them that.
Okay.
There we go. Here's what the band should be more accurately titled, BJ and Jason Get Ice Cream While They Play.
And talk about Castaway.
And talk about Castaway. Oh.
So we we walked up about halfway, and we heard the noise that they were exuding from something like an instrument.
Yes, and it was shaped that way.
We promptly turned around, absolutely. So we can't even talk about
it. No, so skip that.
Skip that. Hot, hot heat. What we wanted from the concert was, I think I described it as killers plus two.
Yes, yes. We wanted two decent to really awesome Hot Hot Heat songs.
Exactly.
And actually, going into the concert, I knew the name Hot Hot Heat, and I thought perhaps I knew one of their songs. But
you didn't.
I did.
Oh, you did.
I knew
you did.
Two
That's
of their
right.
songs. But if you put a gun to my head, I couldn't name them now.
If you put a gun to my head, I wouldn't name them right now. I would refuse. I'd say, pull that trigger.
But we did get what we aimed for. We got two decent songs out of them, I think. Two, maybe three.
I think you should describe their lead singer.
Oh, okay.
Because I think that was I think that elevated their music to a different level.
It absolutely did. If you can imagine the love child of Art Garfunkel and Mick Jagger, you would have the lead singer of Hot Hot Heat.
Man.
I mean, he had the afro and everything.
He had the afro. His pants were excruciating. They were tight from like 100 yards
away.
They
made me uncomfortable and possibly sterile. they were very tight.
They were very tight.
But, I mean, the crowd that had gotten there early enough to be absolutely super near the stage before we pushed ourselves right into the middle of
and
them.
And we did. Dr. Pepper's in hand. They were big Dr. Peppers,
They were.
Too.
But the crowd seemed to enjoy them.
They did.
And I think the crowd that was there for them was a slightly younger crowd than us, as opposed to the Killers crowd.
Which, holy God.
There's a lot of 40-year-olds, a surprising amount.
There were. I remember one such 40-year-old. Mm,
yeah.
This has nothing to do with the concert yet, I guess.
Yeah,
we are going to get into their music. So we are crammed in tight.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I feel a woman next to me, and she's shoving against me, which is rare. usually she's like shoving away.
Right, like shoving, with the hands.
Right,
get away.
Get away. That's against the law.
Right, but it's in French.
Exactly. And so I look over, and this woman is toasted. She is out of her mind.
Drunk. It's unclear how she's still standing.
Exactly.
And she's dragging her totally embarrassed friend
embarrassed
along with her.
And sober friend.
Yes.
And her friend looks at me, and we're those guys who women feel comfortable saying, "I'm really sorry."
Yeah.
Like that's
the
most comfortable sentence for women to say.
Usually followed by, "I'd like us to still be friends," I think. Is but this woman skipped that entirely.
Exactly.
Because she was being drugged by her scantily clad 45-year-old drunk friend.
Exactly. So they move on up, and I'm watching them, and all of a sudden I see something, and I turn to BJ, and the sentence is as follows. I turn to him, and I go, that bitch just fell.
Yeah, I wish I would have seen this. Because
it was a lot of fun to
watch. If there was one person who deserved to pull a Greg Louganis at that concert, it was the frat guy who kept sticking his cigarette in my face. But if there were two people, it was that drunk woman.
And he put them right by my crotch as well.
Oh, well, perfect. Yeah, if you're gonna take out two parts of us, I think you aim for my face and your crotch.
It's true.
The two deadliest parts of experts and intermediates.
That's a deadly combination when we combine your face with my crotch.
It's like the Captain Power of things that were almost burned at the Killers concert.
Okay, anyway, so the music itself.
Music itself. We haven't talked about this actually hardly at all.
I
think
we've
been saving this for this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I used to not be a Killers fan.
Really?
I used to not even like them because the first time I saw them was they were on Saturday Night Live, and the lead singer, whose name I don't ever think I knew, he had a little bit too much eyeliner on for my taste.
Yes.
And so he was just kind of like he was giving it a bit much, and I was in a place at that point where anything remotely emo was like Satan to me. It was like kryptonite. And so I really didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I said I didn't. Then I heard All These Things That I've Done.
Oh.
That summer. A girl played it for me in a car.
Yeah.
And she loved the band. And so at first I was like, no, this band's not that great. I've seen them before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard the song and I was like, okay, I got soul, but I'm not a soldier.
Let's just pause for a minute and talk specifically about All These Things I've Done. It's now no longer a new song.
No.
I mean, they have a second album.
They
now
do.
This is old news. And yet, it is absolutely the most perfect, radio-friendly, sing along since Dexy's Midnight Runners did Come On Eileen. I mean, the bridge of all these things I've done is just, it's built for that.
It is.
And seeing it in concert, they closed with that song.
Yeah, they did.
Except, well, they did, then they did the outro and like a...
Right.
Anyway.
The end of the concert was pretty brilliant.
That was the finale, as well it should have been of the concert.
And BJ called it.
Well, I just think if you've got a song that powerful, I mean, it's like We Are the Champions. You know, you you keep it in the quiver till you really need it.
It's true. But see, but it's like, it's so different than, like, I like Come On Eileen.
Well, who doesn't like Come On Eileen?
I don't know. Any woman named Eileen at a bar, probably, who's not drunk.
That's a good point.
They probably hate that song.
Yeah.
But I like that song, and I don't really like We Are the Champions. But All These Things That I've Done is such a great song, too. And I think it kind of speaks to what their music kind of is. It's definitely kind of like pop rock.
Oh, sure.
But the writing, I mean, this isn't exactly pop writing.
No.
I don't think.
No. And they get undersold, I think, as a band.
I think they do.
I actually was talking to... someone down in Warrensburg, someone whose musical taste I actually really admire, and she said, I mentioned we were going to the Killers concert, she was like, oh, I don't like the Killers. And I was like, how can you not like the Killers?
Right.
And that's when I realized that the Killers, they're widely regarded, I think, as frat rock. And, I mean, look at the people who were at the concert. I mean...
It's true.
Like 40-year-olds and frat guys.
It's true. And us.
And us.
Their music, their actual, like, what they're doing is so interesting, and it's so much smarter than Nickelback or crap, just crap Praise like that.
Yeah.
Or, because that's more like rock, like we're rockers.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's so much smarter than like Fall Out Boy.
Absolutely.
And people like that. Like that to me is like frat rock.
Yes.
And like emo rock. And this band actually has something going on in their lyrics. I think we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like, their music is operatic.
It is.
And they
There's
go
a
through.
Sense of drama in their music.
Yeah. And they go through a lot of, like, tonal shifts in the midst of one song.
Yeah, especially on the second album.
Yeah.
Which I think, it just blows my mind that the second album is getting such mixed reviews, because I listened to both albums again in their near entirety to prepare for the podcast. And even the songs that I absolutely adore on the first album sound just a little more simplistic than the stuff that's on the second album. Both sonically and lyrically.
Right. I'm going to have to start saying sonically.
I just like throwing that around.
That's cool. But no, I agree. But actually, I would say that All These Things That I've Done is different.
Yes.
Because that song, it's like, they like kind of front load a lot of their songs.
Yes,
with
they
like,
do.
With like two quick verses and stuff like that. And then they get to this part where they can basically just kind of do whatever they want until they got to bring it home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it lets them do so many interesting things, and All these Things That I've Done is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Because then we just, like, it just stops.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And it just, like, it's just like...
Yeah, this driving backbeat.
Exactly.
Very spare.
Exactly. And it just... But that's... That's the part of the song that everybody looks forward to.
Oh, yeah. At the concert, I mean, it was... And you know, the lead singer, whose name I now wish we knew, absolutely was working at that song. And he has a very odd presence, I thought, in concert.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about this. There wasn't a lot of chatter.
No.
There was hardly any.
Yeah.
It was pretty much song, and then maybe the lights would dim, and they'd take a quick break while they got a drink of water.
But it would be completely silent.
Completely silent. I've hardly ever seen anything like it. And yet, if you look at the way he dresses and the image he presents, and the way he handles himself when he's singing, there's definitely a personality at work there, just maybe not one that's comfortable expressing itself outside of songs.
Which is kind of really interesting. Like he can dress up, he can have this kind of cowboyish look.
Oh yeah.
But you know what? He kind of doesn't really want to talk to us.
No. Like maybe he's very nervous about talking to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So
The one thing I think he said that I was very amused by was after they played Read My Mind.
Oh, which is my favorite song, I think, from the second album.
It's a very good song.
Yeah.
I haven't decided what my favorite is. but he goes into the microphone as he's walking toward the back of the stage. He goes, He goes, I know our new album sucks, but I love playing that song.
Right, which was great, and it also made me so sad. Because I was like, the album doesn't suck, it's so much better.
Right. I wanted to be like, you son of a bitch, you don't know anything.
And he may have just been saying it as a joke, exactly. But who cares? It was it was still by far the one flash of this person kind of showing us what he has. You know, just being a little bit clever, a little bit showy in between songs.
And it's nice to see that at least like he's aware of how people are reacting to his music. But
yeah,
you know
absolutely.
What? I'm with you. I like the second album so much better.
Sure.
So much better.
I think it's a much more mature album, and I hope they do continue to grow that way as opposed to going back to kind of more of a stripped down, straightforward sound that a lot of their songs on the first album had.
Now, okay, so what do you like? Take me through why you like Read My Mind.
I don't know. Can You Read My Mind just has sort of that same kind of mix of optimism and resignation that I think exists so perfectly in All These Things I've Done.
Yeah.
I mean, every time I hear the line, if you can, hold on. You know, even Tom Waits, who's not exactly an optimistic singer,
right,
has a song called Hold On, and it's a very straightforward, optimistic song.
It
could have been a radio hit if he didn't sing like Tom Waits. But yeah, so I feel like Can You Read My Mind has that same kind of mix.
Right.
That same sort of mixed message and mixed emotion. And it shows complexity. And there's almost a whimsical quality to it.
Okay, I love the intro and the outro on the second album.
Oh,
and I love that they incorporated those into their concert.
Well, and you know, the more I listened to the second album today, the more it seemed to me that so much of that album is made to be played live. And the funny thing I always think about the intro when I first listened to it is like, I was like, why is the song Sam's Town before the intro? I mean, just for the fact that A, it doesn't make any sense. But B, I mean, Sam's Town isn't really like an opening song.
It's not, but I sure do like it.
Oh, I love it now. I like it. My appreciation of it has grown since we saw them live.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. I just thought they nailed so many of their big songs in concert.
Me too.
Which is what you want a band to do.
Yeah.
You don't want them to leave something flat.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
One of my favorite songs from the CD, I don't know if I'd say my favorite, is the one that they did not play
the
in
closer.
Concert. And it's Why Do I Keep Counting is the name of the song. What I really like about Why Do I Keep Counting is in the chorus, there it's like, help me get down, I can't make it, help me get down. If I only knew the answer, I wouldn't be bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the song to me kind of seems almost like a prayer.
Yes.
In some ways. And I love how kind of brutally honest that is. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know what, God, I wish I knew the answer because I'm not sure I want to have to ask you for advice.
Absolutely.
But I need some help.
Yes.
And I think they even say, help me get down, Father.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes,
so
they
it's pretty on the nose. But for some reason, that really appeals to me. But then the last, I think, minute and a half to 2 minutes of the song is just like a repetition of the chorus.
Yes.
Like they do the chorus, little break, another chorus. Mm-hmm. And then they like really punch the chorus.
Yeah.
And I like how varied their songs are, that like sometimes it's these kind of sweeping like emotional feelings, and other times it's just like observation, 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 like in your favorite song.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and you know, it's funny you should mention Why Do I Keep Counting, because I think we talked a little bit about this, how I at least hear a huge Queen influence in the second album. And it's one of the reasons I like it, I think, a little bit better, because I do love me some Queen. And they're not nearly as campy as Queen. In fact, there's very little camp involved.
It's true.
But there is sort of that operatic feel that we talked about, that sense of a sweeping storyline continuing and emotions. A desperation, I think, is a recurring theme in a lot of Queen songs, and it's certainly there in Why Do I Keep Counting.
Oh, good Lord,
And it's a perfect way to end an album, I think. It really is an excellent ending song.
Mm-hmm. And I like how like they're operatic and sweeping, and yet in kind of some of those like Southern epic things, like the name of the album is Sam's Town.
Yeah.
And so it's also very small.
Yes,
And it,
you know why it's called Sam's Town?
I do not.
That's the casino where they got their start. They're a Vegas band. They used to play a Sam's Town casino.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
Yes, and you know, they mention kind of a recurring theme both in the music and in the lyrics is they talk about circuses, they talk about performances, they talk about being on stage. And I feel like becoming a huge hit after their first album, obviously that makes any artist reflect on what it means to be in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. And this one isn't nearly as, you know, self-absorbed as lamenting. I mean, I feel like, you know, one of my favorite bands growing up, Counting Crows, although no longer, but their second album is, I mean, it's like Adam Duritz could not have hated being a celebrity more when he wrote their second album. And it's completely obvious and it's off-putting in some ways. This album is not. This album is toying with the idea of celebrity and toying with the idea of what it means to be a performer. And I think that's why that intro and outro exist, because it gives it a sense of ceremony.
Exactly. Excellent point. A sense of ceremony is definitely present. And you know what? I love that at a concert.
Oh, yeah. It was just great. Like, I remember they started the concert with, I think, the first three or four tracks in album order from their second album.
And I thought that was – and then you looked at me, and I think you were –
I was confused.
Oh, really?
Not that I was like, I wouldn't have mind if they just sat down and played the whole second album, but I like it. I like a little gamble, you know? I like things to be mixed up.
See, to me, it seems so ballsy to just play the album.
I agree.
And I think at some point, I think you mentioned, you were like, are they just going to play the whole album?
Yes.
And I think I said something like, I kind of hope they
do. Oh, yes.
Especially if that means that they play Why Do I Keep Counting?
You know, a lot of the things I've read about this album is people talk about how it kind of has a cheesy vibe to it, and I don't think that's entirely accurate, and I don't think it's entirely unintentional.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, if we talk about it in terms of them considering what it means to be a rock band and what it means to perform, there is a sense of kind of cheese to the whole thing. I mean, it's,
look at the Mark Wahlberg movie.
Look at the lead singer of Hot Hot Heat. It's like he was three steps away from camp, you know?
Yeah, I think he was three steps past camp. I think this guy missed the camp and went straight into the river. So, well, all right. That is our thoughts about The Killers. If you agree or disagree with our takes, which I've stolen directly from Film Spotting.
Good. Well, props to Film Spotting, then.
Props to Film Spotting. If you agree or disagree with our thoughts on The Killers, please send us an email at feedbackbjason@hotmail.com.
That's the letter B and then Jason.
That's right. It's BJ and Jason combined. A melding of our names.
Woo!
So send us an email, let us know what you think, or visit us on MySpace.com. I think it's MySpace.com/UntitledPodcast.
We should change that.
We should certainly change that. We're going to take a quick break, and then we are going to come back, and we are going to talk about action movies.
Absolutely.
Welcome back. This is Experts and Intermediates with BJ Gailey. I'm Jason Eakin, and now we are moving on to our next segment, which is about action movies.
Action movies.
All right, so we have made lists of action movies that we like.
Yes.
You want to start us off?
Well, you know, I think we should start off by talking about how difficult it is to make a list of action movies.
It really is.
Because, first of all, you know, they just don't make them like they used to, folks.
I'm 23 and I agree.
You know, it seems like the 80s and 90s were decades rife with really totally awesome action films.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe completely mindless action films, but that's kind of the point.
I would not even agree.
Really?
My love for them is so great that
I couldn't bear to insult them.
It's true. It's like, it'd be like insulting my own child.
Well,
which doesn't exist.
In any case. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, this is going to out me as a complete dork, but as I was explaining to Jason off the air, in video games, the lines are pretty clear. You got your action video games or shooters over here, and you got your adventure video games like Legend of Zelda over here. Mm-hmm. Can you put a movie like Indiana Jones on an action movie list? It's really not an action film.
It's...
What makes an action film?
Exactly. What does make an action movie? If you go with things blowing up, as a lot of people do.
Which I think is requisite.
Then V for Vendetta is an action movie.
Yes, although...
It's not.
This is another problem, is that with the popularity of comic book films. Yeah. They've really supplanted what used to be action movies.
They have.
Or even what used to be big showpiece, like summer movies. And it's really skewed the whole genre towards a science fiction edge.
Uh-huh.
So let's just jump right into the list. And
okay.
We can make some qualifications from
there. I've definitely got a lot of mine deal in some way with science or the big science thing of technology.
I think we're going to overlap, I think, in a couple here.
I bet we are.
So number one on my list, and anyone who disagrees with me can meet me outside, because I will punch you in the face if you do not think that Die Hard is the finest action film ever made. It's in my mind, there's no question about it. It has all the elements in a successful action film should. There's exciting action sequences or set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
There's an excellent villain. One of the best film villains I think I can remember. A villain that's equally, although I think not more, interesting than the lead character, John McClane. In John McClane, I think they created such a flawed human being who succeeded not because of any particular skill or strength or even that he was very smart. John McClane's actually kind of a dumb guy, but because he was just too stubborn. It's basically he succeeds because of his flaws.
In some ways, yeah. And that's what's so great about being like a regular guy.
Yes.
Is that it allows him to be both. It allows him to be awesome action hero and really stupid guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And both pay off and don't pay off at different times.
Right. He gets himself into as much trouble as he gets himself out of in
exactly.
the film. It's got some nice supporting work. Like characters you actually care about, even though they don't have maybe a lot of screen time. It's got great humor, but without sacrificing the characters ever. I mean,
which is something we're going to get into.
Oh yes,
in a little bit.
Yes,
which is what I think the way action movies have gone.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like, and you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you have to answer for a lot of that.
thought of another movie.
You and your taglines. I don't begrudge you. I'll be back, but
that's a great line.
Well, sure, it's a great line, but did he have to say it in Eraser? Did Eraser have to exist?
No.
Did Vanessa Williams ever have to be in a movie?
She's not in a movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Eraser does not make my top five.
Eraser does not qualify as a movie. It qualifies as a motion picture, but these are technical definitions and not what we're talking about.
We are splitting hairs here Experts and Intermediates. That's actually what we were going to call it.
Splitting hairs.
All right, what's your number one?
We thought people would think that was a hunting show.
Really? Not a haircuttery show?
No. Oh, for God's sake.
Haircuttery.
I'm offended. I completely agree with you.
Die Hard
is my favorite. When someone says action movie, that's what comes to mind.
Agreed.
And it is, I would say, a perfect movie.
Yes.
And I think one of my favorite things about Die Hard is how uncomfortable it made me the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
Because.
Absolutely.
Especially at that age, if there's people are chasing money, and then at the end of the movie, the money is just somewhere else and they've moved on and they've found peace, I'm always like, where is the money? Why is no one going to get the money?
Right.
And so the fact that he takes his shoes off and then doesn't have shoes for a long time put me on edge.
Yeah.
And the whole time, in every scene, I'm thinking, how can he get shoes? How can we get this guy some shoes? I don't know how, but he needs his shoes. Life will be better for him if he could just get shoes.
Yeah. Some people in the audience were concerned about John McClane's wife. Jason.
His feet. It put me on edge. It put me totally with him.
Oh yeah.
Because I was like, if I was in that situation, the last you can have a gun or you can have shoes. I think I'd pick shoes.
Well, sure, I'd quit. I'd give myself up. I'd be like, listen, can I get sandals? Something.
If he had sandals, it would have been worse. It would have.
All right. Number two.
Okay.
Number two for me is Leon, the professional. Leon, the professional, as the French say. I almost hesitate to put it in the action movie category, simply because I think it is such a fine film. I mean, action movie.
Well, Die Hard, by the way, is on my top 100.
Oh, yeah, Die Hard is a fine film as well, but it's the exception to the rule.
That's true.
I mean, generally, I think when you're talking about action movies, you're maybe talking about a great flick, a mm-hmm. great movie, mm-hmm. but not film.
That's true.
The Professional, to me, is a film.
It is.
And it features the same qualities that I think make Die Hard great, some excellent action sequences, a villain that is not maybe equally as interesting mm-hmm. as the protagonist, but in this case, very close.
Yeah.
Even though Gary Oldman chews more scenery than Patrick Stewart in that film. I forgive him. It's a quirky enough character that I think he can get away with it. And The Professional certainly does. It has, to me, a very rewarding ending. And it features maybe, well, not the last great Natalie Portman performance. But,
closer.
But, bah.
Bah!
I wasn't impressed with her performance. I actually have not been impressed with a performance of hers since
Star Wars Episode One.
No, she's terrible in the Star Wars nerd. Films. Here we go. Natalie Portman, ladies and gentlemen. At some point, Natalie Portman decided that she was really hot, and she is.
Yeah.
But it's like all her acting ability and ambition went out the window. I mean, it's like once she hit 15, she stopped acting.
I disagree.
Except for the Saturday Night Live digital short where she did gangster rap.
That's true. That was some amazing character study right there. Her performance in Closer is phenomenal. The whole movie is phenomenal. You can bah all you want.
I do bah.
That's incorrect.
However, I think we can agree that this film features a performance that is well beyond her years.
Oh, yeah.
In The Professional. Oh,
when I first saw it, I was so surprised, and wonderfully so, by, of course, the scene where she just plays dress-up.
Oh, sure.
I mean, going into this movie with Gary Oldman, and seeing Gary Oldman in the scenes we've seen him in,
sure.
Who's gonna think?
Oh, yeah.
Out of anywhere in the universe, mm-hmm. this, it's like out of the Star Wars universe, comes Natalie Portman acting like Chaplin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like...
Credit to Jean Reno, absolutely, yeah. In that sequence, too, because he's his completely... socially awkward,
yeah.
Almost stunted character of Leon is,
I would say so,
is just great. He's mm-hmm. so underrated in America, and
yeah. mm-hmm.
just such a fine performance. And you know, I think, I guess the common theme we're talking about in these first two is that they're action movies that manage to build in character moments.
Yeah. Although I've never felt like The Professional is a full-on action movie.
No, I agree, and that's why I am very hesitant to include it. And
as
yet,
well, you should be.
And yet, I don't think it falls neatly into any other category.
Yeah.
And I think if we're going to have one true film on this list, I think it's going to be The Professional for me.
Okay.
What about you?
Let's see. Another really good one, Terminator 2.
Terminator 2 actually almost made my top five.
Yeah.
It was knocking
not
on
quite.
The door. Not quite, and not for any really good reason.
Okay.
Terminator 2 is one of the best theater-going experiences of my life. I distinctly remember seeing it in theaters. It was a packed house, multiple standing ovations. Same thing with Die Hard when I saw it. Just one of the few times I've experienced that in a movie theater. Terminator 2 is infinitely superior in my mind to Terminator 1. Terminator 1's a good film, but it's a horror movie. I mean, it's... substitute the Terminator for Jason Voorhees, and it's, I mean, there's no difference. Yeah. Terminator 2 succeeds in being an action film, whereas the first one does not. Terminator 2 succeeds in providing character moments where the first one does not.
Yep.
And it's that great, you know, we talked about this, that great Cameron tunnel vision.
Yeah, well, I think we'll talk about Cameron a little more later, so I won't talk about him too much, but I'll just briefly say, like with a lot of his movies, he knows how to build a story.
Absolutely.
And he understands.
Visually and, I mean, textually, I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just, it understands how to have a good sequence.
Yes.
The word sequence was defined by Terminator 2 and some other Cameron
movies. I think that's probably true, actually.
I absolutely do.
So, now, well, we've come to an interesting point here, where the last three films you've named are films that straddle that line.
I know it.
Between science fiction and action.
And I've got more.
Oh, yeah. I got... Aliens. Let's talk Aliens for a moment.
God, yeah. We're on a Cameron kick.
It's proudly residing in my number five slot. Any way you shake it, Aliens is amazing.
It is. I've been on an Aliens binge.
It's great. I love to hear this. I love to hear this. Can I say for a moment, just really quick, I'm so pleased because Jason had not seen Aliens until recently.
I hadn't.
And it does my heart good that my DVD copy of Aliens is not collecting dust on my shelf.
I think I've put your Aliens DVD to better use than you have.
I think that's probably true. I think I got it and put it right on there, the shelf.
Wow. Because I watched it, and then I watched the 2 hours worth of behind-the-scenes stuff with cast interviews, and I'm currently about halfway through the commentary now.
Nice.
Which is kind of a bit of recycling from that, but it's okay. So much great stuff, just the way that, like, they built the creatures and the way that they had to shoot, like, the final sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so difficult to, like, put the, like, two guys are, like, back-to-back controlling the mother alien. And the fact that it's all, there's nothing digital in the movie.
Thank you for bringing that
and
up.
And it succeeds where a lot of digital movies fail for me.
And I think for the it succeeds for the exact reason that a lot of digital movies fail, is that there is something tactile that film picks up that is absolutely missing in most films. I mean, forgive me, George, most of the prequels never seem real.
No.
Yeah, so like Aliens, probably one of the last films that really didn't lean real heavily on CGI. I mean, even Terminator 2, the liquid metal, I mean, I remember that being touted as just the technological advancement that was going to save humanity.
Or kill it.
Or kill it and take its voice those and guys, call it on the phone.
Those guys did not see the movie, apparently.
But Aliens, yeah. I mean, what bad can you say about Aliens? Even Bill Paxton, who ruins everything he touches. Oh, no, he's great.
No, he's
great.
Not.
Oh.
Even Bill Paxton can't even hurt the movie very much.
And I think he helps it. But it's got those awesome Cameron sequences that are just so exhilarating. And
better sequences even than Terminator 2.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Much.
So intense. The entire movie manages to retain that feeling of dread that Alien had.
Yeah.
But builds it into a completely kick-ass gun fest.
it does. And here's what I love. Here's what I mean about like Cameron's storytelling ability. Movie opens and it's 57 years later, and Ripley is just being picked up after the first, and she's been frozen. So for her, it's basically the next day after the first.
Yeah, after
movie.
This hellish day she just had.
Right. And so she's, you know, they ask her all these questions. Blah blah blah. Eventually goes back to this place she just got away from because they decided that 57 years in the future they're gonna mine this place and ends up having to save all these people and stuff. Obviously action movie ensues, but the first hour of the movie manages to do a lot of great things without ever really having an action sequence.
No.
We get a dream of a chest burster thing, but it's just a dream. It's very quick, and otherwise it's convincing her to go. Mm-hmm. It's getting there. It's introducing all these other people.
Yeah, these Marines, which, while they don't have very much screen time, are by and large pretty sharply defined.
Yeah.
Maybe by action movie stereotypes, but at least successfully portrayed and very likable.
Yeah.
So when they all meet their inevitable death, it is somewhat affecting.
It is. Like, even the, I think the Colonel, or Apone is his name.
Oh, Apone, sure.
Like, when he dies, there was a part of me that was like, well, what are they going to do?
Yeah, right. Yeah, where do they go from here?
Exactly.
They've lost all their Marines by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
All these killers, these space gun-toting awesome guys are saved by Ripley in a power loader.
It's right. And he manages to capture an amazing action sequence that is both chaotic and yet clear.
Yes. Like, and he's one of the few guys who can do it, I
exactly.
think.
Exactly. Most people cannot pull that off. It's too much, jerking around the camera, and it's like, oh, that's, you know, that puts you in the mood of what is going on in the chaos. Well, I still need to understand it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Cameron is a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker.
He is.
And anyone who does not think so, I think just may have a chip on their shoulder.
Well, after Titanic, who can blame them? But, I mean,
after Pearl Harbor, you've got to thank him, though.
Oh, that's true.
You got to thank him for not making Pearl Harbor.
This is true.
Because he didn't. I want to talk about one last thing with Aliens, which is something I think we also talk about with action movies, is how they can shift from almost genre to genre. It can be a chase movie.
Sure.
It can be It can be a one-on-one.
It can be a caper film. It can be a western. Mm-hmm. Some westerns are more action, I think.
And holy crap. There's nothing... I think the most amazing setup in the movie where I just thought, like, as great as I thought Cameron was at the beginning, he just reached a whole new level, was she's killed all these aliens. She's walking through this thing with this girl, this sea of these eggs, and slowly she begins to see how vast. There's just this, we know it's big because we see this giant tube where these eggs are coming from, and it's huge, and already I'm scared.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like slowly reveals this giant, satanically scary queen alien. And I got chills. Oh, yeah. I literally got chills while I was watching it.
Yeah, and then, and in absolute, like, I mean, like, feral den mother mode, Ripley goes berserker and torches all the babies. Awesome.
Oh, man. And then it's a chase between the two of them. Yeah. And so the last 20 minutes of the movie are one-on-one.
It's a huge sequence.
It is. And
that ends in a fist fight.
Pretty much.
A glorified fist fight.
And you know what? I mean... So many movies, that would be like the tacked-on thing, and it'd be like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so go ahead.
The last one I have that really straddles the line between sci-fi and action is The Matrix.
Yep.
I don't know that I can name a movie that is more exciting to watch to me, despite all its massive and well-documented flaws.
I'm not familiar with any of these, for the record. I'll freely talk about the flaws of the Star Wars movies, but if you want to talk about the flaws of The Matrix, then I just give you a confused stare.
He's looking that way right now. It's like someone lobotomized him or replaced him with a large mannequin.
I don't understand the conversation.
In any case, no one can argue, whether you're me, Jason, or Jesus. Mahatma Gandhi, or Jesus, no one can argue that The Matrix isn't completely thrilling. The bullet time concept, while to be honest not new to The Matrix, is maybe new to live action film. I mean, this is one of those devices that I think it's like when Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out. My friends who had never watched Kung Fu growing up were like, it's amazing, this wire stuff. I'm like, dude, you've never seen, like, Master of the Flying Guillotine? Come on, man. It's like they've been doing this stuff for 20 years.
But I did know that it was – I did at least know that it was around.
Right.
Even though I hadn't seen it.
And so I think Bullet Time maybe is, while perhaps not the completely original invention some people believe it to be, is still utilized far better than any film that has come after it, even. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one has improved upon that look.
No, they've ripped it off. And it's always felt like a ripoff.
Yeah, it's always felt completely shameless. And not even, like, some movies can rip something off and be completely shameless about it, but succeed in being more exciting.
Right.
No one has topped The Matrix for that.
Yeah.
At least for me.
And we even like, for what they are, we like The Matrix Reloaded.
Absolutely. I think The Matrix Reloaded, because I've pointed this out 1,000 times, to some people, Matrix is their Star Wars.
It's mine.
Well, yeah, and that's totally cool. It was never that to me.
Right.
I thought it was an awesome film, a great kung fu movie. I mean, still, if we do a top five kung fu list, it's going to be near the top. So, like, when I saw Reloaded, I didn't have sky-high expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I expected that there'd probably still be some terrible dialogue, probably some wooden acting, and probably some awesome action. And I got more than I expected in the awesome action category.
Wow, no kidding.
What else you got? Because I got one I think you may have forgotten.
Okay. I've got The Rundown. Have you seen The Rundown? The Rock is a terrible actor.
You know, actually...
But you know what? I love The Rundown.
I'm going to go on record as saying The Rundown is not nearly as bad as I thought it would be.
Oh, it's... I'd say it's good. It is. I mean, it's kind of a buddy movie, but not exactly.
It is a buddy movie. I still can't say it's good, but it's...
I can.
It's not the total trash on film that I thought it was going to be.
I would recommend it. I would recommend people seeing it. I think it's worth seeing. It's fun. He's got a whip at one point.
He does. Some of the action sequences really are very inventive and fun.
Yeah.
And Sean William Scott, if you can put up with him for longer than 10 minutes,
right,
does have actually a line that I quote on a near weekly basis from
which
The Rundown, which is when he's about to fight The Rock and he's shaking his leg, indicating that maybe his leg's going to kick The Rock at some point. And he says, "Who is this? Do you know him? Is he your friend?" And I do say that sometimes.
Wow.
I'm weeping right now. I can't believe you brought up the rundown.
I did bring up the rundown, but I can't quote it. There's nothing quotable about the rundown for me.
But I didn't say I'd recommend it. You are on record now saying you'd recommend the rundown.
I'll recommend the rundown as a movie you can watch and admire and forget. You're not recommending the movie as something that you
and yet I'm quoting it.
You've learned it. You've acquired the rundown.
Well, maybe that's why I don't recommend it, because if people are interested, I just give them the 10-minute best of clip that I have memorized.
Where you use a whip and break chairs with it.
Yes.
In a Mexican bar. It's not in Mexico. I don't even know what it is.
Who cares? This is the reason why Rundown doesn't make our top five, because almost everything about it.
But it's so much better than, like, the Rush Hour movies.
You think?
Especially Rush Hour 2.
Oh, well, Rush Hour 2 is barely a movie.
Exactly. And Rush Hour 1 didn't have that much action.
Well, no. It did not have that much action, especially compared with some better Jackie Chan vehicles.
Jackie Chan First Strike
had awesome action sequences. That's about it. Rumble in the Bronx had some awesome dubbing.
Oh my gosh. I can't put up with dubbing like that. I can't.
Dubbing is bad. That's why you cannot watch the Man with No Name Western trilogy. I mean, I really want you to watch it, but I know that you don't love Westerns, and I know you hate Westerns. Dubbing.
But the Wild Bunch is on here.
And Wild Bunch is an amazing film. Although I don't know that I count it as an action film.
I don't know if I do either. But it's got some great gun scenes.
It does. And it's certainly the most visceral Western I can think of.
True.
I mean, that's kind of its claim to fame anywhere. We're not adding anything to the world's knowledge. But
not really.
I mean, we do have to give it some props, because it is action-packed.
It is. Okay, so what's this one that I have forgotten?
Kill Bill.
Hmm.
Is it an action film? I think it is. I think it's Tarantino's only action film.
Why do you think it's an action film?
Because it's a kung fu movie. And I think kung fu movies go squarely in the action film genre.
Wow.
Yeah, take that.
I think, okay. Anything else? That was very terse.
I think the movie is composed around its action sequences.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot more going on, because it's a Tarantino film. And, I mean, if it didn't have that razor-sharp dialogue and completely eccentric and yet totally accessible characters,
yeah.
I mean, in the hands of a lesser person, I think we wouldn't even hesitate to call it an action film.
But I think
it might be a very forgettable action film, but it would be an action film.
See, here's what I would say. And this is kind of, we could kind of get into Grindhouse, but we won't. That could be a good segment.
Grindhouse, yeah. Would you do that?
I think if it was someone else, there would be more action sequences. I think the amount of action sequences would be at least double.
There's a lot of action sequences in that movie, though.
First one has Vivica A. Fox.
Yeah,
which
is awesome.
Which is awesome. Then it's got the anime sequence.
Yeah.
Then it's got the end.
Yeah, but the end is like a 45-minute sequence.
It's a 45-minute sequence.
Of nothing but fighting.
Not true.
Oh, it's primarily fighting.
I've timed it.
You've timed it.
You bet I have, because people told me it was 45 minutes, and then when I checked my watch and realized it was like, I think it's literally only like maybe 13 minutes of actual fighting. I swear to God.
Yeah.
It's 45 minutes from the time she goes into the restaurant
sure.
to the end of the movie. But the last action sequence in both Kill Bill movies.
Yes.
Like the one-on-one are both not really action sequences.
So you don't think her fight with Bill in 2 is an action sequence, and I think it's as riveting as some of the lightsaber fights, like some of the good lightsaber fights. We're not talking about like original flavor Star Wars lightsaber fight with the spin move with Kenobi.
See, I think wow.
Yep, feel it.
I just did. If ever I felt the power of the Force, it was right now. I think the whole point in the second movie is that these two characters are deeper than an action sequence, and that their climax is not a fight. Their climax is a conversation that has a sparkle of violence, but is not primarily violent.
And yet involves swords.
And yeah. No, but it's It's definitely not a full-blown action sequence.
I mean, I see where you're coming from, and I completely agree with you that it is more character-driven than any of the films we've mentioned so
right,
far, with the possible exception of The Professional.
Which is why it was interesting that you didn't put that you said what you said about The Professional.
Right. I still put it squarely in action films. I just think, okay, Casino Royale. I went back and forth on it. It ended up not making my list, but boy, it's close. It's certainly the best Bond film, in my opinion, ever made.
Absolutely. Hands down for me.
I mean, it's a real movie. And it has the best chase sequence I can think of.
Yep.
At least in recent memory, maybe ever.
You haven't seen Apocalypto.
No, I've not seen Apocalypto, and you tell me that's
pretty good chasing.
Nice. But it's better than Casino Royale?
I'm not sure.
Comparable. Okay, well, I'm excited to see that.
All right, so keep going.
Yeah, okay, so Casino Royale, but that's an action film, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Absolutely.
And yet, how many action sequences does it have?
Big one at the beginning. Another big one at the end. There's a torture sequence, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, but not an action sequence.
When else are there guns?
That's it.
Are you serious? I've only seen it once.
The movie is primarily card playing and character development. I mean, there is the huge set piece action sequence at the beginning, which is awesome, and the huge one at the end, which is, in my mind, still a little unnecessary and kind of extravagant.
Yeah, I felt the same way. There's got to be more. There's got to be some fist fight.
Here's the deal. The only real fist fight is the flashback sequence at the very beginning that's in black and white in the bathroom, which is completely great, and for me, ranks up there with one of the more disturbing action sequences. Like, it actually reminded me of the fist fight in the second Bourne film that's shot really dirty and messy. And
those are also really good action films.
The second one, I think, especially. The first one I didn't love so much.
Oh, but I feel the opposite.
Really?
Clive Owen in the first one puts it over the top for me.
Mm.
Although the fact that in the second one, it's Jason Bourne is from Nixon, Missouri. I am Jason from Nixon, Missouri.
Wow.
Makes me feel like Matt Damon.
It's almost like I can't get near the computer because, like, the ego is huge.
It's true. Ego eek is what some people call me. Is what I tell them to call me.
Well, sure. Why wouldn't you?
I don't know.
But I mean, I really think, like, I think the number of action sequences in Kill Bill far eclipses. Especially if you consider the two Kill Bills one film, which they are.
Which, yeah, I absolutely do.
I think it dwarfs Casino Royale.
I don't know that it dwarfs it.
Well, I mean, action sequence-wise.
It's like a deaths per capita.
Well, it's
deaths per minute.
No, then it's Kill Bill all the way.
Scenes, action sequences per minute. Kill Bill movies account for, I think, like 5 hours.
Yeah.
Or 4.5 hours.
Something like that.
Whereas Casino Royale, if it has two more hours to kick up.
I still don't think he kills as many. He certainly doesn't cut off as many limbs.
No. Maybe he doesn't kill as many, but I'm saying, like, action sequences. I wonder how many minutes of action are in Casino Royale.
How many
straight flushes there are in Casino Royale?
Well, that's
Royale.
The thing. Are we counting card games as action sequences? Because
I guess
if we are, then that movie's got a solid hour and a half.
That's true.
Anyway, this is not a discussion that will be settled, but
it's not.
All right. Well, okay. That's interesting.
I don't put Kill Bill in action movie.
Okay.
I put it in great film.
That's not a category.
Sure
that's
is.
A descriptor. That's an adjective.
So is action.
No.
Action movie.
Damn it.
Action is an adjective.
Damn your logic.
I think it's grammar.
Oh. Ooh. Experts and grammar intermediates. You'll notice no comic book movies.
No comic book movies. No, I love the action in like all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and things like that. Not action movies.
I agree. I think those are more clearly adventure films, just like Indiana Jones is more clearly a strictly adventure film.
I think we can close out the old action movie list. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think some good points raised and
I think so, and some good disagreements.
Yes, yes, in interesting stuff for the assignments section. I think perhaps.
Oh goody!
Yeah.
So if you've got action movies that you think we completely overlooked, do not send in Seven Samurai. It's not an action movie.
For real, guys.
Seriously,
this is a problem.
People wanted to put it on. I swear, people put it on lists with like with Die Hard and stuff like that. That's not.
It's offensive.
It is.
It is not an action film.
Nope.
It's not even a kung fu film.
It's not. It doesn't count. It's great. Doesn't count.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But if you have action movies you want to send in, feedback, B Jason, letter B, letter J, letter A, letter S, letter O, letter N.
Wow.
At hotmail.com. We'll look at them and probably write you back and say that you're wrong.
Yeah. I think that's accurate.
I think that's accurate. So we're going to take another break, and we will be back with a little bit of a segment about books that we read.
All right, we're back. We are moving on now to our third segment. This is going to be a fairly loosely constructed segment.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about basically just the type of literature we're interested in at the moment in our lives, stuff we've read recently we've really liked, and at the end we're going to be giving each other our assignments.
Assignments for the week.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
We really need like a music cue there.
We certainly
Something
do.
Something ominous.
Something from The Killers?
No.
No, probably not.
All right, books.
Okay, books, here we go.
I've recently been on a classic horror kick. Where I moved through, I started with Jekyll and Hyde, moved through Dracula and Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
and I hopefully will be starting I Am Legend pretty soon.
Wow.
Yeah, which is kind of a
What have you thought of the books?
Honestly,
because I haven't read any of those.
Well, I'm going to let you know.
Oh, good.
I really loved Jekyll and Hyde. It's a short, which I go for.
You're going to hate my advice.
But the thing about Jekyll and Hyde, which is awesome, and I highly recommend it to people, is that assume for a moment you lived in an alternate universe where Jekyll and Hyde wasn't like a pop culture reference.
Right.
You would never see the ending of Jekyll and Hyde coming. I mean, it is so cleverly handled in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You care so much for Jekyll. And you worry so much about him that you cannot possibly think for a moment. And there's nothing in the book that really gives you clue enough to make the determination that they're the same person.
Uh-huh.
It's just so surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, obviously, everyone knows that
right.
the end of Jekyll and Hyde. And yet, when you're reading it, my impression was that, I mean, even while I was reading it this time, I was like, something's going to happen.
Right.
There's an explanation for this. which is great. I mean, I don't think there's a higher recommendation for a book.
I don't think there, especially not one that is part of the national or international
identity.
Lexicon.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish the same could be said for Frankenstein, which I thought was, I mean, just absolutely the most effective cure for insomnia I've seen in a while. The creation of the monster takes, and I don't exaggerate here, about a paragraph.
I've heard that.
It's just not what you expect.
Uh-huh.
So
then what primarily does the book spend its time doing?
The book primarily spends its time talking about Victor Frankenstein's intense feelings of guilt and remorse at having meddled with the fundamental forces of creation, which we all know there's probably going to be some of that thanks to literally hundreds of years of this being manufactured and resent through the pop culture assembly line.
I think best done in Van Helsing.
Oh, absolutely. I think nothing communicates that sense of remorse better than Van Helsing.
Or than people coming out of watching Van Helsing.
Oh, truer words were never said. I saw that at the Dollar Theater, and it was a dollar too much.
I saw it opening weekend. I dragged my brother.
Oy.
Yeah.
Well, I really think the sequel, Van Helsing 2, Van Helsinger,
it's true.
Will be better.
I do too. I think I was going to call him Van Jackson.
Van Jackson? Can we call him that now?
I think we should.
I think Hugh Van Jackson. This actually goes in the category of Teely J.
Teely J.
Teely J, for those of you at
home.
Sounds
like a drink.
Is Tommy Lee Jones.
Teely J.
Yeah, we've decided, I think, that every week we're going to try and rename a celebrity, and I think we succeeded here. Hugh Van Jackman is just awesome. when he does the Wolverine film, I think he will be credited as that.
Hugh Van Jackman,
Esquire.
I love it.
Hugh Van Jackman, Esquire.
Comma, ESQ.
Or sport. okay, so yeah, Frankenstein, avoid.
Gotcha.
Now, Dracula, on the other hand, really was a very good read. Just an awful lot too flowery and Victorian for me. And yet, you really don't get an authentic sense of what the novel is about from any other cultural source. I mean, no Dracula film you've ever seen will prepare you for how terrible and truly despicably evil Dracula is in the book. Because I feel like every movie, with the exception of like the Hammer films and, you know, the old B Van Helsing versus Dracula awesomeness, I think all the more current incarnations of Dracula really treat him as a romantic figure.
Okay.
And let me tell you, there's none of that.
Hmm.
None of that. These people are taken not against their will, but they're put into a state where they cannot refuse.
Gotcha.
I mean, basically, Dracula is slipping women roofies throughout the countryside and then having his way with them.
I was going to say, this is the original date rape.
This is seriously, Dracula is a date rape novel. Dracula is totally worth reading, but just be prepared that, I mean, it's not going to be riveting. Every minute. It's not going to be terrifying, although there is one sequence that is, to me, astoundingly horrifying.
Hmm.
Not because it's grotesque or surprising, but because it really does. I read Dracula. My deal was I was going to read Dracula, and I was going to read it only at night.
Oh, wow.
And I succeeded.
Good plan.
Yeah, it was a great plan. But it's not, like Frankenstein, it's not a book that you can read for long sections at a time.
Gotcha.
So, that's my spiel on what I've been reading lately.
That's what you've been reading? Okay. I kind of get on novelist kicks.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of read a lot by one novelist at one time. But now that I've done that, I just kind of have to take them piece by piece.
Mm-hmm.
So two novelists I really like are Jonathan Franzen. He's probably my favorite novelist. And Rick Moody. And they happen to be, I think, pretty good friends.
Nice.
So
are their styles similar? I have not read either one of them.
Franzen is much more long-winded.
Mm-hmm.
Except that's not the case in the books that I'm about to talk about,
which
is very surprising. His books are usually like, all of his novels are 500 plus pages.
Mm-hmm.
Moody's are usually less than 300.
Oh, very short.
Yeah, very short. And yet his novel, The Ice Storm, which I've read within the last 6 months, one of my favorite books, it feels longer because he gets so much mileage out of the words he does use.
Nice.
And so I really have to credit him for that. Very quick read. But I read both of their memoirs. So Franzen's is called The Discomfort Zone, A Personal History, mm-hmm. I think. And Moody's is called The Black Veil, A Memoir with Digressions.
Yeah, and we've talked briefly about
that. And both of them seem to accomplish the same thing, which is that they give kind of – they cover a lot of range. They cover mm-hmm. a lot of years. They talk about early childhood – not really adolescence, well, a little bit of adolescence in Franzen, but a lot of, like, in the 20s and college,
mm-hmm.
and then now. But they do it in such different ways. Franzen, I think because his novels are so long,
mm-hmm.
here, this book is less than 200 pages, which shocked me and kind of disappointed me, because I like to get into, like, a meaty Franzen mode, because he can be very, just very intricate in his writing. And here it seemed kind of like this was leisure writing in a really good way, though. He really just kind of was relaxing
mm-hmm.
and just really had some just kind of memories he wanted to share. So he talks about his love of Snoopy as a kid.
Oh.
He talks about the pranks that him and his junior high buddies mm-hmm. used to pull on their school and does talk in pretty interesting detail about those and then moves on to trying desperately to lose his virginity while he was in college and failing over and over and over again.
Nice.
And so it's very fun. And then I think he finally lost his virginity to the woman he eventually married.
That's sweet.
Well, they've since divorced, so it ain't that sweet.
Oh, not so sweet.
which is how Franzen talks. I've garnered from interviews.
Well, I see. You told me that you read both of these as audiobooks.
It's true. I did. And I actually made my own tapes. I made mixed CDs of them reading.
You'd read a chapter of Moody and then have
exactly,
them.
Exactly. So meanwhile, so Francis.
Memoir DJ.
That's right. So, and I don't read memoirs. I haven't read A Million Little Pieces. Don't care to.
Well, that's the thing. I read
like a page of it. It was terrible.
I am not a nonfiction reader. I can count the number of biographies and autobiographies I've read on one hand. They just primarily don't interest me.
No, so, yeah, neither of these are really like a biography,
right,
which is good.
Right, but it's still very much someone talking about personal
Friends
experience.
Is born.
but
in Rolling Thunders, Webster Groves, Missouri.
Wow. My point is, though, they're not
down
like...
Down the interstate.
They're not like casting their personal experiences in a fictional setting.
Right.
I mean, this is just them talking, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's well, Franzen.
Right.
So now we get to Rick Moody.
Oh, yes,
who,
okay.
While Franzen's trying to lose his virginity, Rick Moody is graduating onto very dangerous narcotics.
Sweet.
which he does not seem to recommend. And... just get, like, he was a raging alcoholic, mm-hmm. by which I mean he basically shut down completely every sense and nerve in his body,
mm-hmm.
and almost kind of folded into himself. And so meanwhile, so he's talking about this kind of stuff, he actually skips a lot.
Mm-hmm.
His was a little bit less satisfying, but maybe more fascinating.
Okay.
Because he skips kind of a lot of his personal details and goes for the history of his family. And so the history of his family goes back to a story written by, what's the guy who did Scarlet Letter? Nathaniel Hawthorne. Wrote a story called The Minister's Black Veil.
Yeah, oh yes.
Which
right.
was in a little footnote, says it was about a preacher, based on a preacher named Mad-Eye Moody. Or not Mad, sorry, that's Harry Potter. Handkerchief Moody is what they called him, because he wore literally a handkerchief over his face for the better part of his life. I think over 20 years
right.
or something like
that. Then that would be the Minister's Black Veil in the title.
Yes.
The titular Black Veil.
The titular Black Veil. So you've got him trying to figure out what went wrong in this guy's life and what has gone wrong in the whole slew of Moody's since then, and actually finds a lot of books about Moody's in history, because they're all sort of on like the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And like him and his dad go to towns where they lived and take these journeys and try to go to grave sites and all this stuff, look up old heirlooms and artifacts in libraries and things like that. And so it's really, really interesting. And he kind of comes to the conclusion that not only his family, but every person just about in some ways veils themselves. And he's trying to figure out in what parts of himself can he unveil. And he
right.
he doesn't really make cover, he doesn't make a lot of headway
right.
With
right.
this.
So the book is basically about him trying to decide what he will reveal in this book.
Right, and coming to the conclusion that he's a writer, and it's hard for him to reveal things, so...
That's why he's a writer.
He's very sorry. that basically is it.
Interesting.
But yeah, and like there's the story is actually printed in the back of the book, and he spends about 45 pages analyzing it based on book after book after book of analysis of the story. So if that can get a little rough to read
sure.
sometimes, especially when, I mean, that's the digressions that he's talking about in this title. But they both kind of get to some interesting places. Yeah, so that's what I've been reading. I also read a book called Perfume, The Story of a Murderer, which I don't think I have the strength to go into right now.
That's
so
probably,
great.
Probably for the best.
Is my hatred of this book. and it's fantastically written. It is expertly written. The writer himself is brilliant. He's a brilliant writer. And probably the worst human being on the face of the planet.
Which, I mean, I think, to me, this makes me want to read the book.
No, I would recommend people reading it, but I would be furious if you like it. Do you know what,
yes.
know what I mean?
It's no, like, I actually do know. It's one of those experiences that you want other people to share with you so that... so that you can be like, okay, good.
Right.
You hate it too.
Listen, it takes a lot. It takes a lot to offend me.
Mm-hmm.
This book, I wrote in the book, and it's not even my copy. I wrote inside the copy, this is perhaps the most offensive and nihilistic writing I've ever read.
Nice.
It is so... He basically hates all of humanity and gets off on being completely cruel to them. And that is something that I cannot abide.
Well, it doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
No, it's not, and it's just the book just comes off seeming very. You can just get the sense that this author thinks he is really, really superior to the world.
Yeah.
Not just like a couple people, the world.
The world at large.
And it's not a little superior. It's a lot superior. So that's a turn off to me. Maybe it's a turn on to you.
Yes. Well, if you like that kind of stuff, check out Perfume.
If you're into feeling superior to everybody else, and who isn't now and again,
sure.
Check out Perfume, the story of a murderer, and go straight to hell.
Well, should we give assignments?
We should give assignments.
All right.
What is your assignment for me?
For Jason's assignment, we're going to give him some music. My original plan was to give him some music that I thought kind of related to our experience with the killers.
Uh-huh.
Now, for me, on the extremely shallow level, I was dying to give you Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, wow.
Simply because Art Garfunkel possibly could also be the singer for Hot Hot Heat.
I think he appeared incognito.
However, instead, I will give you another folky, Bob Dylan.
Okay.
Not because he has anything to do with the Killers, but because through my train of thought, Art Garfunkel is directly connected in my childhood to Bob Dylan.
Outstanding.
I would like you to listen to Blood on the Tracks.
And I will.
Which I think is, in my opinion, his best work.
Wow.
I think it's really like kind of the 1-2 punch of Dylan that most people like. When they mention Dylan, they're like, oh, Blood on the Tracks. So listen to that one. You're going to recognize some of it. It's one of those Dylan albums that really, I think, probably every person who breathes air should own or at least be familiar with. I will also give you a solo singer who's actually a lot closer to the Killers than Dylan.
Okay.
I want to give you some Springsteen.
Oh, wow.
And I think for Springsteen, we're actually going to jump right in and give you Nebraska. Not his most rockin' album.
Okay.
The Boss has had a lot more rockin' albums than Nebraska.
Lord.
But Nebraska and Blood on the Tracks, I think, will actually tie in kind of well together.
Okay, neat.
Do you want a third?
Yeah.
You want something totally different?
Sure.
Okay. I will give you, and you will hate it.
Oh, really?
I'm going to give you this, and you're not...
Why are you doing that?
You're not going to like
it. You're supposed to give me things I'm going to like.
Well, you're not going to like it, but I love it.
Oh, God.
I'm going to make you listen to Rufus Wainwright. The reason he came up in my mind is because the Killers really, like we talked about, have kind of that very dramatic vibe.
Yeah.
Rufus Wainwright does that Queen sort of drama right now better than anyone else.
Wow. Well, give it to me. I really haven't listened to it's been at least 2.5 years.
I'll give you Poses, which is his second album. Kind of the starter album, I think. Most people hit Poses first and then go backwards and forwards.
Time for assignments for BJ.
Yes.
We are definitely... Obviously, we're going to give him a film.
Sure. I need him.
This will... And you've seen Scenes from a Marriage.
I have, although, I mean, it's been a while.
Okay, so that may be one to revisit. You have a lot of movies of mine.
I do.
So we are going to give you two of them.
Oh, good.
We're going to give you a movie that especially among, like, people who are in tune with critical opinion, or especially, like, more artsy people,
mm-hmm.
they actually don't like it nearly as much as I do, so this will be fun.
Oh, good.
The Departed is not only the best picture of last year, according mm-hmm. to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences,
sure.
it's my favorite movie of last year.
All right.
And it was my favorite movie of last year by far.
Really?
Yeah. Nothing came close to it.
Really?
So okay. I am giving you The Departed.
Good.
And so we'll just see if you got anything close to what I got out of
All
it.
Right.
So now, aside from The Departed, we're going to give you a movie that could not be different.
Sweet.
And is also on my top 10 list from last year. and that is Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story.
I was actually really hoping you'd recommend this. I've been this is the one you've gave me that I've had to chomp at the bit to not watch.
Oh, man. This is a movie. I've watched it. I think I've watched it like 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. Watched the commentary. The commentary is hilarious because mm-hmm. it's the 2 stars. It's such a weird movie, and neither of the people I've watched it with have liked it even half as much as I have, even though they still claim to like it.
Right.
I love this movie.
Okay.
And so that is your other assignment.
Awesome.
I think you especially will really get into it.
I'm digging the idea of it already. Just reading the back of the DVD.
It's just.
I'm very excited.
I'm not even going to say anything about it until you watch it.
Cool.
There's just no point. Those are our assignments.
So until next time, I'm BJ Gailey.
I'm Jason Eakin, and we will see you later.